When along came a semi with a high and canvas covered load. If you're going to conch a hawking horse with me, you can ride. So I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. I said, if you can't take these twists and turns, man, I don't blame you. I said, listen, I've traveled every road in Pennsylvania. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the valley stair, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel I've had my share, man.
And here's the thing, it's better than some other papers in the area.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, and so this is trying to like get at the fucking part
right
of what's going on
right
here.
Right.
You know, like we did a great one with Carissa after the...
That's one of my favorites ever.
Yeah, with the after we did the counter-protest.
Yeah.
That's one of our top hits ever.
Yeah, so it's like... That's one of my favorites, just because we captured that moment of, like, you see something and you start collective action.
That picture I've described over and over again to other people. The picture I'm talking about is her holding the rainbow painting and the paint is running.
Yeah.
Because it's still wet. And I had told people over and over again, to me, there is a biblical quality to that picture because it is essentially Exodus. It is essentially the Jews leaving Egypt so fast that the bread has not risen.
Yeah, yeah.
She,
the paint is not
dry. She was so there that she did not let the paint dry. And I just think it gives me goosebumps, actually, because it was so important to her to be there that she just went home and she drew it and she was out there before the paint was
You know
even.
What I would love to see that in a review about our podcast on Apple Podcasts.
There we go. I'll do it.
Thank you.
I'll do it.
But that's
2 years later.
That's the point, you know, because it's like the Daily Item didn't do an article on that.
No, of course.
You know, and you know, and then let's like And that's like activism and movements and
real.
It's super real.
It's not this sort of glossed over, good for grandma kind of content. You know.
Yeah, it was great.
You know, I think we should actually kind of have that start in there because I think that was a really good moment. So that'll be kind of our like soft intro. But so welcome to Barnstorming.
Yeah.
We have a new guest. We introduce yourself, Ben.
Oh, my name is Ben Schneider. I'm a local here in Lewisburg who...
Are you really?
No, transplant, technically. Yeah, technically.
But local now.
As of I'm registered here, so that counts for something, right?
We've talked about this. I think unless your grandparents... I mean, of course, you're a citizen and all that. Like,
sometimes I don't feel like a true local because my parents are from here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, my in-laws... go back to this area with like 15 generations, if there's such a thing. It's like
there is such a thing. Yeah,
yeah. It's deep.
Not 15.
Then
you'd be native, but
yeah. Well,
8 or 9.
Yeah, 8 or 9. It's deep.
So this is pretty exciting because we are in a new studio. As longtime listeners will know, we have a habit of moving locations. This is the first time we've been in the studio of one of our longtime sponsors.
Yes, we are recording here at Mondragon Bookstore.
We're about to say that, aren't we?
It's 111 Market Street. Do you know what 111 means in binary, Jordy?
I think it means new friends.
Yes, that's right.
I forgot that. That's a good...
Yeah.
We've been around so long. We have a vault with deep cuts.
that's only the longtime listeners will get that.
Yeah.
Stupid joke.
We also have another one of our unpaying sponsors here. We've got some Lafroig.
Yeah.
Do you like it, Ben? Have you had it before?
It's got a great smooth finish with a hint of peat.
A hint of peat?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Did you drink it yet?
No.
Oh.
No, actually, I haven't had it at all.
Oh, I have a taste. Okay. Most people would say it has a hint of peat, like a sledgehammer has a hint of weight.
Lafroig's. And if you guys are listening out there, just saying.
We should actually maybe send them an email and see if they'll.
Well, you know, I actually did look at talking with them about a sponsorship, and they're owned by some huge multinational corporation. Yeah, it's not. I don't think it's a tree I'm willing to bark up.
So listen, we have an agenda, and I'm already going to screw it up because we were talking about news right at the beginning and the daily item. And I am, by the way, personal goal of this podcast, I'm going to work on speaking a little softer and a little slower because I have a bad problem of speaking too quickly. Right now, I think I'm speaking more slowly.
I think you're speaking a little too slowly.
We'll see what happens after that. LaFroigs is gone.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's true. Actually, we have to ration ourselves. So here I am, like, back to – so the Daily Item endorsed David Rowe in the special election, I believe, right? I didn't see it.
Officially?
Mm-hmm. They did officially endorse.
Officially endorsed. And somebody said actually a really great letter to the editor by John Mitchell pointed out that they wrote specific editorials about guns and
redistricting
about positions the newspaper was taking that were in direct contrast to David Rowe's positions, and yet they still endorsed him. But
they did so because he, like, represented, quote, the view of the voters.
Even that, so two things. First of all, I feel like in the, like, way we think and talk about elections, you know, we have a winner, and it used to be, maybe this is idealistic, it used to be that person who got elected, you know, won with a majority, but then was there for all of the people. And I feel like more and more it's like, he deserves to win because he represents the views of, like, the majority who voted for him. And we've just given up the idea that the election is one thing and governing is another. And, you know, that's deeply problematic. The main point, real quick, I wanted to get to was, like, I don't give a shit about newspaper endorsements. I think they should stop, like, all newspapers. Just stop endorsing candidates. I think issue – taking position on an issue, but I was just curious what you guys think.
Well, I think the stupidest thing about that endorsement was – the idea that they sort of endorsed that how you feel about issues is the most important quality of a state representative or of any government official, to me, probably not issues. It's your ability to listen and be there when you need to be. And, you know, I didn't.
Does a newspaper's endorsement affect your thinking about who you're going to vote for?
Well, it certainly pissed me off, but I was pretty.
But you were going to vote for Jen.
I feel like there is, first of all, a newspaper is, for whatever it's worth, has a bit of more of a kind of up higher on the hierarchy than, say, like, anything on the internet to me, right? It's this, like, published document. It has a history, right? And so in that realm, in that sort of idea, it's kind of one of those things where it should be a little bit more bipartisan to me. It should be just reporting, right? And to me, an opinion is, like, the, like, opposite of information. It's really just, like, it's spin, right? That's what an opinion is. It's your rhetoric. And it just doesn't really belong. I mean, unless you're writing a specific editorial. So, like, unless you're saying, like, this author from the Daily Item has this to say, and my editor said it was okay.
Yeah, I'm not talking about comments. I'm about when the newspaper, when the editorial board of the newspaper says, we as the newspaper endorse X candidate.
To me, that's, like, totally weird. Because it just.
Like, how did that even start?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, also because, I mean, it's more common, I know, in the UK.
And on both ends, right? I mean, it's like, if they were doing it for Democrats, I would say
all newspapers.
Like, it's just a weird thing.
I mean, if you're an opinion, like, publication, like The Nation or The New Republic or The National Review, those are opinion pieces, publications, but, like, your basic newspaper, who I agree with you, like, their basic mission is to try and inform the public. And I think, you know, having an opinion area where they try and get a range of opinions, that's totally consistent with that mission. But the group of editors with no name, right? It's just we, the organ, as the organ of this newspaper, are saying this is who we think you should vote for. I don't know the historical roots for it, but it just, like, I was like, I don't like
and,
it.
And having it be anonymous is also weird.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, because it's just sort of this, like, amorphous thing, and you're like, okay, so according to who? one guy, 10 guys, all guys.
Yeah, we're all guys.
Three women.
Did they disagree? You never get the minority.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like, you have no idea. It's just
and they
like
never really not endorse either, at least at the Daily Item. So, I mean, are they all unanimous decisions, like you said?
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, I want to know.
Someone has to disagree with something, right?
Yeah. You would think.
I feel like, I mean, what would be maybe if they, maybe, this just popped in my head, maybe here are three reasons to vote for this person and three reasons to vote for this person.
Yeah.
Just like.
Pro-cons.
You know, not even con, just here are three good reasons to vote for this person, three good reasons to vote for this person.
Yeah.
And then, you know, and they could maybe actually serve a role there. All right. So that here's the next thing we want to do. I've for some reason been thinking about movies, and I randomly looked up a list from Business Insider.
Maybe we should say what we're going to do for the rest of the like,
Nah. Okay. We do that sometimes, but so these are this was meant to be our warm up. We did the editorial, but anyway, here are five movies that are supposed to be best political movies according to this thing on Business Insider. So I'm going to go from five to number one. So I'm going to say the name of the movie and like maybe the year it came out, and then at the end we're going to see how many of them we've seen. And I know that I hold myself to a pretty high standard that I'm like a political, like I'm interested in politics.
I'm not very interested in movies, to be honest.
Oh, in movies. Okay.
I hold like, my both at a low standard for almost both of these things.
Okay, great.
So I'm curious now.
Yeah, yeah. So number five is called A Face in the Crowd from 1957. Has Andy Griffith.
I never heard of it either.
Andy Griffith, though.
Yeah. I'm actually interested in it. We'll go back to it. The Manchurian Candidate, the 1962 version.
Sure.
I think I saw the more recent Denzel Washington.
You know, yeah, I haven't seen the
okay. All the President's Men. Dr. Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb. And Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Saw that.
You did.
With Jimmy Stewart.
Yeah, with Jimmy Stewart. How about you? Have you seen any of them?
None of them.
I've only seen All the President's Men. And people who know me well are like, you've never seen Dr. Strangelove? I'm like, I kind of know what it's about. It's about a nuclear weapon. I guess I should. I only saw The President's Men maybe in the last 2 years because my younger son, Allie, is really interested in investigative journalism. Like, he's probably the only 15.
Oh, I didn't see. Is that the one with Deep Throat?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I didn't see that yet.
It's a very good movie. So, yeah, my son Alex.
I accidentally written it. I was trying for something else, but, you know.
I've seen Spotlight, the one about the Catholic.
I was trying to see that new Spider-Man movie.
Yeah.
Like, it just wouldn't load.
So. Yeah.
So, yeah, the Face in the Crowd, I'm most interested in this one because, A, it's Andy Griffith. This is what it says.
Pretty slow down.
That one of his best performances is playing the despicable Arkansas drifter, Larry Lonesome Rhodes, who becomes one of the biggest commentators in the country thanks to his unfiltered good old boy talk. However, his thirst for power leads to his demise. I mean, that sounds very timely, right? Like a populist radio voice who becomes corrupted by his own image of himself.
Did you guys ever listen to the NPR podcast Throughline?
Mm-hmm.
It's recent, and they like trace some like contemporary phenomenon, and you know they trace some contemporary phenomenon back to like its roots, like several hundred years ago or 100 years ago. Or something.
You've told me about this.
And they had a good one on evangelical Christianity, and they just you know traced evangelical Christianity from its arrival in the U.S. all the way through now.
Right.
And so they had one actually on like bad relationships between like U.S. politicians and the media.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just looking at Huey Long, who was like this, mm-hmm. you know, like bombastic Louisiana politician in the
20s and 30s
that was assassinated, actually. And he like had this like crazy radio program that was like broadcast to 30 states and stuff like that and ran for president and was
so the through line that is particular politicians in the media having tense relationships
through line the is just the it's that the NPR
but Huey Long was an example of what
like a kind of like a proto dictator that had a really crazy relationship with the media.
Sure.
So here's I just looked up a quick quote from him about legislators.
Huey Long.
Yeah, Huey Long. This is a different one. You sometimes fight fire with fire. The end justifies the mean. I would do it some other way if there was time or if it wasn't necessary to do it this way. That is that is exactly what makes people clutch their pearls, like good government types, because like, oh, there must be a rule of law and a system. And I know for myself, like with populism, I mean, I feel like, you know, like whatever my coming of age as a liberal progressive was like, populism was a bad word. You know, populism leads to bad leaders. But ever since the Great Recession, I'm much more like, you know, there's two kinds of populism. There's right wing and there's left wing. And, we, you know, this is a populist moment. There are.
Yeah. Now, how would you go ahead and define this idea of populism in your more modern context?
In any context, and I'm borrowing this guy, Jeff Juris, I think wrote this little book about it. Populism is a kind of political mode. It's not necessarily an ideology, which is, I think, sometimes people combine what a populist says. Like people say Chavez in Venezuela was a populist and that's bad. It's more about your style of politics. And so populism says there's the people and there's some elites who are out to oppress or crush or whatever them. And in general, left-wing populism is about there's us and there's people who are trying to oppress us.
Sort of like the 1%.
Absolutely. Yeah. 1%, 99%. Right. And Trump is right-wing populism, which says the reason that you're being oppressed is some like other elite.
Right.
Jews, immigrants,
right.
Blacks, whatever,
right.
Political
right.
culture, liberal right. elites. Right. And so it tends to be triangular, right? It pits
yeah.
the people versus another group of people.
I always just kind of always am fundamentally distraught by either, I mean, I guess I kind of had always defined it as the idea of democracy, but maybe it's more actually what you're saying, this idea of populism. But I've always been a bit distraught by this idea, which is like, well, what happens when the ignorant far outnumber the enlightened? And you use the word enlightened loosely there, right? Because I don't want to like make that too dramatic, but you know, in any type of democracy or populist system, if the people who are ignorant just far outnumber the people who are not ignorant, then the ignorant people always win because they're always the majority. And so that is not really a particularly efficient way at choosing leaders or also making decisions on anything. With that being said,
like
you know,
majority rules.
Yeah, I mean, essentially, I mean, obviously there's enough checks and balances within our system to try and prevent that from happening. But, you know, like, I mean, the most extreme alternative to that is like what Plato would call like the philosopher king. You know what I mean? This kind of idea of like we take the absolute smartest, most enlightened, most like clear-minded individual and we just give them kind of totalitarian power, right? Which was Plato's idea. Yeah, he was totally wanting to run for president.
No, it would be me.
Oh, it would be Jordy Gomez.
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah.
how bad could it be? What could go wrong?
Great ideas. There'll be some great ideas. The accounting.
It's the 50th anniversary of the,
the accounting.
The great paella disaster.
Yeah.
The shrimps. The shrimps.
Many good shrimps were lost that day.
Can olive oil be a currency? I mean, for sure, you know, and I think people often, when we have conversations about like these big topics about, you know, democracy or governance, like we imagine a system like what you're saying, you know, immediately imagines like people deciding on a thing. But of course, what we actually have is people making choices about people we put in charge of government. So there's a kind of, you're talking about the checks and balances, but there's a whole, you know, even if the people said, like in a direct democracy, like, I'm going to make this really simple. Like in Lewisburg, we shouldn't have meters. Okay, well, who's going to take them down? And, you know, like people can make a decision, but this is me having studied organizations. There's always going to be an organization that actually has to carry that out, no matter what the decision-making mechanism was, whether it's direct democracy or representative democracy. So that was just kind of an observation
right. So what you're saying, you basically just have the logistics of...
What I'm saying is that any conversation about how we make decisions
right.
tends to kind of simplify the reality that you can make a decision either with direct democracy or representative.
Right.
Like, 'cause I think one of the things you're saying is, I think, that it's a problem if the ignorant make the choice. I mean, you didn't say that, but that sounds pejorative, right? It's bad if the ignorant outnumber the informed.
It's not necessarily – okay, was it bad? I tend to shy away in whatever possible way of kind of making these good, bad dichotomy things, because it's always what's good for me is bad for you. What's bad for you is good.
Well,
let's
put this up. Why did you bring up the ignorant would outnumber the informed?
Because I think the issue is not necessarily about what I think is good or what you think is good. I think what it comes down to is what is the expertise level of each individual, right? So, like, I get the same amount of opinion as anybody else gets, right? But my expertise level doesn't have to be in any field at all. I just get to say how I feel with a vote. And to me, the problem is that we are voting very party lines almost all over this area in Pennsylvania. And there's really no critical thinking that's happening, right? So the ignorant really represent a group of people who are not qualified, not because they're stupid, but because they haven't used any critical thinking about the decision-making process. And so my point is, what happens when all of these people start making decisions without thinking it through?
I don't know if you have a historical reference point to this, like as if it's worse now than it used to be.
No.
Because I think that is endemic to our political system. That will always be the case.
Yeah. And that's sort of like
tough. It's an issue. It's an issue.
Yeah, that's tough.
I mean, you can advocate whole-scale political revolution. I mean, it's your opinion. I don't mind. But I was just like, when you say that, it seems like dot, dot, dot. Therefore, we shouldn't let people vote for.
No, because I think, like, to my point about Plato, like, that was a tyrant he was describing. So that's not so good either. You know
right.
what I mean?
Then you end up with Winston Churchill. You know, democracy is, like, messy, but it's the least bad of all the alternatives.
You know, and so I think, like, yeah, I mean, yes, I guess there is this, like, dot, 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 you know, of...
Then what?
It would be better if people were less ignorant.
Yes, and I think actually that's something that you can do something about.
Well, you know,
right? Because education is the gateway to that thing.
This is why we have public education and public libraries.
But see, I think that this is a myth of sort of, you know, classical liberal, whatever you want to call it, this idea that, like, people with more education will be better voters.
No. Well, yes, I guess that is sort of where
I just seems like so many issues that we deal with, like, we imagine this kind of a whole, like, you know, universe of these little rational actors who, given more information, will make better choices. And what it avoids to me is that, like, people don't gather information and go through a, like, logical process of making decisions about almost anything, really, unless they're being very and in politics, especially, because the stakes are often about much more emotional things. Who are we as a people? What should our goals be as a society? They make decisions through, like, the lenses of values and stories. So what we need to do is, to me, and this is why some people would clutch their pearls, because I'm advocating a kind of populism, but it's like the way to do politics is to talk about who we should be and what we care about. And when you get to policymaking later, if you win, then yes, you should be more logical and informed. But
I think we should move on to the next topic. But I also just want to say really quickly, I was reviewing this study that was surveying politicians, scientists, and the public about nuclear
energy.
And it went through a whole bunch of stuff about how safe these three groups of people thought it was. And
who thinks it's the safest?
Probably the scientists. I don't remember that, but I would guess it's the scientists.
Sounds like it.
But they surveyed, who do you think should make decisions about where a nuclear reactor should go? And the scientists thought it was the politicians that should decide.
I know where this joke is
the
going.
It's not a joke. It's a real thing.
But it is a joke.
It is a joke. Yeah, no. And the public thought that the politicians decide.
And the politicians want
the people to decide. Yeah. Everybody thought
that,
someone else should.
That,
no one wanted to, like, I'll make the decision. Yeah.
Let's put it right here in the middle of Brooklyn.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That is so fascinating.
Yeah, and true story, the Swedes put their nuclear reactor on an island right next to Denmark.
That was what they were deciding.
Yeah, we're
going to
put it next to Denmark.
They don't like pastries that much anyway. So
we shouldn't go into this vault, but my senior thesis, so you don't know, but we both went to college in Minnesota in the same town.
Oh, wow.
Slightly different schools. there's two colleges in this town, and we went to
it's
different
a small
ones.
Town like the size of Louisville.
That's
there's
funny.
Two
different colleges.
They're, like, on the end of the same street.
No, there really are opposite. Yeah, you know, with a river, a creek between them, a river, small river.
Cannon River.
But anyway, my senior thesis was the Mississippi. Yeah, yes. On the Mississippi River, they put a nuclear power plant next to a small Lakota reservation. My senior thesis was about a plan to store the nuclear waste outside of the containment facility in these things called casks. Poor marketing, because it sounds like caskets. But these basically these big concrete structures, because of the mountain in Nevada, Yucca Mountain, I think,
yeah.
That's supposed to be the place that the scientists said is good to have it. The politicians empowered the scientists to have it there. The people in Nevada don't want it. So, you know, to me, it's like this interesting, kind of goes back to what you're saying, like, it's not as simple as the people make a decision and then it's followed, you know, like there's more elements that are part of this process, but we're known for our very abrupt segues. Let's talk about the PA85 special election.
Okay.
Do you kind of want to do an overview of your article that's on Medium, your summary?
Yeah. So kind of hit this couple key themes. It's actually not published currently, but it will be by the time I imagine people listen to this episode. I did like a last thoughts on the race, and I did it so that I could kind of get some emotional closure with it. The first part of the article is going over some maps, and I found a general results map, a comparative map between Jen's performance in 2018 and 2019, and then the turnout map. And then I went through some various like observations that I had or what ifs. And then lastly, I kind of ended with thoughts ahead. You know, like we got fucking crushed basically. And what do we do now? Like looking forward, how do we spend our time? What can we learn from this about other, you know, politics in Central PA?
So,
yeah.
So let's give people the numbers. In 2018, Jen in the 85th district. Yeah. So this is just last fall. She got basically 32%. And now let's round up. She got 37. So she swung at 5 points. And a couple of 4.5 points. That's more accurate. And turnout was really high. Do you have the overall turnout? 40%, something like that?
It was something like 40, yeah.
So a couple of things. I mean, one, you know, when she ran last fall, she was running against an incumbent and she was a complete newcomer. She had never run for office. And of course, this is an area that is so Republican. We know our friend John Peeler has studied that going back to when it wasn't even Union County, but looking at whatever county it was then, this area has been voting Republican since the last time I voted for a Democrat. Andrew Jackson ran in 1828.
It didn't vote for Andrew Jackson, I don't think. Or maybe it did.
Well, it at least didn't vote Republican then.
Was there even a Republican then?
There was not a Republican. It was voting Whig then, but it didn't vote Democratic Party.
Yeah. Well, we actually voted for Teddy Roosevelt and the Bull Moose Party.
Right. Did we? Anyway.
We did, yeah.
The point is very Republican. So, and you also have some historical stuff. The last time somebody made a serious run for this was Steve Connolly, and he got about 30%. Is that right?
Yeah, I think about 31 or 32%.
So that's interesting. The other thing is when I was trying to figure out, you know, if people know politics, usually you do like a win number or a path to victory where it's a simple spreadsheet. You put how many registered Democrats, Republicans, Independents, and what percentage turnout you'll get of each and how much you'll win. And people, I was trying to, special elections in August are hard to estimate because, you know, there's not a good historical precedent. People who are much more experts than me were like 10, 12, 15%. So, I mean, this area votes like the 40% turnout in a special election is an insanely.
Now, 40% is of the entire registered population.
No, it's never.
Registered voters. Of either party.
Total.
Gotcha.
I don't. It's roughly similar.
By the way, I'm a chef by trade, so if anyone's listening, this is why I'm asking these questions.
No, but those are good questions. You know, I think most political, like, you know, hardcore political data junkies would be amazed at the turnout in an August special election at 40%. Don't you think? Yeah. So, Taylor, when you wrote your article, I'm going to bring up some things that are points of difference between you and me. You talk about the students would have been a nice growth. Let me talk about paragraph three, growth outside of Lewisburg and Sealand's growth. I was excited to see that a lot of Dr. Gent's support came from outside of the boroughs of Lewisburg and Sealand's Grove. Take out that apostrophe, by the way. Democrats saw serious gains in East Buffalo Township, Penn Township, Kelly Township, Union Township, even McClure Borough. I don't even know where McClure is. Is that Western Snyder County?
Yep.
Dr. Gent won resoundingly in East Buffalo, where David Rowe lives and was a township supervisor. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Looking ahead, I very much so. You quote John Peeler.
I think that that's actually true.
I'm not disagreeing with that.
Okay, yeah. Which is exciting, I think.
Okay, I'm not finding a good quote. Basically, I got from your article the tone of this was like, look, we lost, but this is steady progress towards a future. I mean, you do talk about it becoming blue. It's somewhere in this. I'm pretty sure.
I said we'll have a close race in 10 or 15 years.
No, we won't. Like the problem we have is that we gin ourselves up that we're going to do this and maybe we're going to win, and we're not going to win.
Well, I don't think
that's a cold stare you got, Jordy, right now.
Yeah,
real cold.
From me to him, or him to me?
From you to him.
Oh.
But it was just very serious.
Sorry, it's not personal.
No. I think of course it's not. Yeah. I think we need to maybe redefine what winning is for us.
Mm-hmm.
We did really well, and I would call that a win. You and I had privately said that we thought that Jen had about a...
I said 1 in 5 chance of winning.
And I said, I think, a 20 to 30% chance.
Mm-hmm.
And,
I mean, I'm glad you brought that up, but I also feel like, what the hell was I thinking?
Yeah, no, I mean, I feel the same way too, you know, but I ended up spending a lot of time on it.
You did. We both did. I'm sure you did more.
Well, I don't know.
Well, that doesn't matter.
It doesn't. Yeah.
But I mean, the point is we're not just analysts here. I mean, we were direct participants.
Yeah.
And yeah, keep going.
Yeah.
And so I was surprised that you wrote this, because to me this reads, yeah, like...
I do believe that, though.
Okay.
I do believe that we are... And I know that some of this discounts a lot of Republican votes that Jen got, that I think... I don't think that Democrats can count on those votes in the future, necessarily.
Right.
But I do think that, on the whole, there's slightly a trend towards blue. I think in 10 to 15 years, we'll definitely have some close races.
I think there's a lot of variables in that statement that are almost impossible to gauge, because 10 to 15 years has too much variability and way too many possible political movements to make any type of judgment on a trend like that. But what I'm curious about, and feel free to, like, you know, move this in any direction that you want, but to try and actually connect a little bit what we were saying earlier, and also something that you wrote in the article, which was about the kind of brand of what the Democratic Party in this area represents. You know, what my question really is like, what is us, as in what is the Democratic Party? And is there really a way to look at this in a way where it attempts to almost shatter the preconceived notion of a Democrat by almost being nothing like any other Democrat, right? And to Taylor's point in the article, there is a really great line in it that I won't be able to see right now because the computer's frozen. But it essentially talks about rebranding
the Democratic Party. I think this is it. I think the best way for this is Taylor's writing. I think the best way for Democrats to make gains in local elections will be to focus on livability issues like safety, infrastructure, conservation, and local business development.
Right. And so the conversation I had, I think it was with you, Taylor, the other day, which is like, you know, let's just take a 50-50 group of Democrats and Republicans from Union County, and let's talk about fishing, hiking, biking, and the outdoors. Literally every single one of those people are going to be
pretty much on the same
page. And so the question I have is like, you're never going to win if you're always trying to be a Democrat.
And throw in there, like, safety.
Safety.
And
right? Education. And now, obviously, growth, to, yeah. And this is why I was linking it with what Jordy said earlier, which
and
is like...
energy, even, for God's sakes.
Right. What Jordy was saying earlier is that the politics comes secondary to the identity. And so I think you're having a bit of an identity crisis as a Democratic Party because you're sort of channeling a lot of energy into things. And I mean, this is coming from a total layman, so I don't know how I'm talking about. But it feels like to me that like there's a lot of energy being channeled into.
Hold on, expertise is not a prerequisite to be on this podcast.
Hey man, I'm just saying. I'm just saying, you know,
you're here for a reason, Ben.
Yeah, I'm just saying that like it is. There are way more middle ground issues that can make a Democratic candidate look way more appealing to Republican voters right away.
Yeah. Well. Let me jump in here. I completely agree with you, and I feel like Jen, even though she did run as like a moderate Democrat that was willing to compromise on issues like guns, that kind of like played into the national stereotype of what Democrats were.
I agree, and I think compromising is really not the right strategy.
And we weren't able to shake the national brand of the Democrats. And if we're going to win around here, we need to shatter that and come up with a new coalition.
Yeah, totally. And I think that, like, for example, you know what I was saying right there is that there's really no reason to, you know, make any of these consignments back and forth between, well, okay, this is what you want and this is what we want. We can meet in the middle, right?
Concessions?
I did, yes. And because to your point about my point on education, right, this idea that the educated voter is the better voter, right? Well, yeah, you're so right when you say that doesn't hold up because some of the most educated people I know use their intellect to be like total racists, right? They literally will intellectualize genocide or racism, and they'll make it this thing where it's like,
now I'm very curious where you're intersecting with these people. I don't need names, but I'm like,
you know, there's a couple of the salty old people around here that I okay. like to chat to, you know.
Yeah,
they're like the crusty intellectuals who I know
one of them's probably next door.
Yeah. Oh, him.
yeah and but he's not nobody, right? To your point, right? There are
smart individuals.
There are plenty of smart individuals who will use their intellect to justify really horrible stuff and just use their mind in a way that will just say like, well, that's what you believe. I can dismantle your logic in three steps.
I mean, when I was 16, I learned from an Outward Bound instructor that IQ and wisdom are not correlated, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely.
Yes,
yeah.
IQ and wisdom are not correlated, right? And I think, so you can't really use the intellectual punch.
Or even better, what you're saying, like book learning and wisdom.
Right, right. What you really need is you need a type of wisdom that is more closely related to, I would say, ironically,
maturity.
Yeah, actually, that's the best word.
Okay, so we can't spend a lot more time on this, but like it's interesting hearing you talk, Ben, because you know I think for me especially, and I think I can speak for Taylor here that like, you know, we consume, you know, podcasts or reading or other things that are often about like, what would you do? Like, how can Democrats do better? And you know, you and I both know what are the key steps to that process in this area, right? Like you invest in like organizers and infrastructure so that you do what are called like listening canvases. You don't just show up to ask people to vote, but you invest in having people go around and actually build relationships. You build out neighborhood teams, Obama's campaign. You know, I know you've talked about this. So you build a whole infrastructure to bring people along to what this brand of the party is. And we could imagine putting, you know, that money in, that time, that effort, and I don't know that it would make a difference in 2 or 4 or 8 or 12 years, because we could talk about the hunting issues. We could talk about local business development. We could talk about reversing the brain drain. And as soon as a David Rowe or a Donald Trump or a Corbett who ran for governor, Wagner, as soon as they say, but abortions, and they're going to take our guns, that will undo all of that.
Well,
it will undo all of it.
I wonder that, because I think that, you know, and again, this is one of those situations where I've said before my thoughts and people have dismantled me with these like intellectual yet like totally irrational ideas. But, you know, first of all, my opinion on the gun thing in general is this idea of removing guns is idiotic. You're never going
to
remove.
But I'm going to pin you on that for a second. It's interesting because to me, and I'm just saying this in an observational way, that is the language of like the right wing noise machine. No Democrat runs on removing guns. It's all about common gun sense regulation or regulation.
Okay.
You're talking about it in their terms.
All right. I'm talking about it in their terms, right?
But that goes to our point, which is it doesn't matter, right? Like when I was at the West End Fair for the Democrats, because right. I was feeling playful, I was like, you know, hey, check out the Democratic booth. Check in your guns here. And that guy turned around. And because right. I was playing to the stereotype as a joke. But
right.
they have done such a good job of investing that brand nationally.
And, you know, and do you mean the brand being...
Sorry, the Democratic brand means we will take your guns.
Yes, and we okay. will... We will. I was watching Fox News right before I came here. And the thing, the little ticker on the,
Chiron.
On the screen,
the Chiron
was like Beto O'Rourke, you know, : abort babies the day before they're born or something like that. And it's just like, no, he didn't fucking like, that's not, you know, like, why are you twisting whatever he said, you know,
right.
he like, who would fucking think that that is a good idea? You know, it's like. They just always go back to abortion and guns. And I know that in the next year with the Trump election, because he's so unpopular, they're just going to do abortion and guns for like...
Abortion, guns, and brown people invading us.
But so the question I have then is this. What really is the hang-up with the abortion thing?
What do you mean by the hang-up?
Okay, this is my whole thing. Is like, if you don't want me... saying anything about whether you can or cannot own or have a gun of any type, then why are you turning around and telling me that I can or cannot have an abortion? If you have the freedom to own whatever weapon you want, I should have the freedom to have an abortion. It's a personal liberty. It is not an issue of religion. It is a personal liberty.
In their opinion, an unborn... or like a fetus is an unborn life and it's not your decision.
Okay.
I'm actually,
they also don't want to
decision,
pay any taxes to support that child after it's born. So really that's pretty hypocritical.
Oh yeah. But when does that stop?
Yeah. You know, human means hypocrisy in Latin. that's not true, but, I mean, I'm fairly sympathetic to this, right? Like if you came to me and you're like, oh my God, you know, over in Middleburg, they are hanging, they're hanging Catholics from the tree. They're lynching them. I'd be like, what the fuck? Like, get my gun, posse time. They can't do that.
Right.
And if you really believe that a little cluster of cells is a human, then it is murder. And so I think that there's this huge mismatch because the language of reproductive justice, like, I don't love that phrase, you know, that language of reproductive justice of, you know, stay out of my body, that I think works a little bit better. That, in a moral equivalency world, does not hold up to that as a person, right? Because that's like this most sacred thing. And I think Democrats, like the best framing I know of it is to say like, you know, ultimately, like this is the most difficult choice people are going to make and they need to be allowed to have the liberty to make it with their family and in their faith. Like that's the best way around it. Or not around it, but the best way to like reframe it.
Frame it, yeah.
But you know, I tried to do that with Claire on our podcast, and you know, it seemed like he was kind of getting it. But you know, you might be able to have one of these deep listening conversations and get, because some Democrats would say don't even go there, and I think it's a mistake. I think it's a mistake to not go there.
Yeah.
I think they should go there, and I think also there is like a really intrinsic I mean, this is probably the least popular thing you could do, but it's worth to, I mean, let's put it honest, to shatter a mold, maybe sometimes what you need is the least popular thing said the loudest, just enough times for people to really get shooken up. But I think there should be a real direct attack at this idea of Christianity or Catholicism being a doctrine in the United States, right? In Buddhism, death is not the same thing as death in Christianity. So the idea of what life is and what death is and all of this totally esoteric philosophical stuff is literally only in the frame of a single religion that this country has decided pretty arbitrarily and historically to like build an entire society around, right? So this idea that like death is like a Christian thing is ridiculous.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if we've gone over this ground before. Like to me, like, you know, and you're a father, I'm a father. There are always exceptions, but if my wife is, you know, 40 weeks pregnant, 39 weeks pregnant, and she just said, I don't want to have this baby, I'd be like, no.
Yeah.
At 37, no.
Yeah.
Like time is relevant here. There comes a point at which I'm like, yeah, it's not a person. And so when that decision happens legally is really a religious freedom choice. It's a religious freedom question.
Yes.
And I don't know if that works, but to say like, we have a long history of religious freedom in this country.
Yes.
And politically, we have to have a compromise. And the compromise is X number of weeks.
Yes.
Right? Because I feel
this
like
this is not a murder
because
issue.
Because I know
it's a Christian issue.
But some people may, you know, well, some people on our side about choice will be like, well, it's not viable. I'm like, you got to be careful with that because viability might start coming sooner and sooner and sooner with our technology. And you know, maybe it should. But I just want to come back to Democratic coalition politics. If
do we have an equivalent of a guns and religion or a guns and abortion thing? Like, is healthcare our
that if you know, somebody would say vote for this Republican. Oh, can we come back there for a second? If so, I know a lot of people who are like, why can't the Democrats get their shit? And, you know, why can't they just be better? You know, people who are sort of like they care, but they're not as involved as like Taylor or me, whatever. And I'm like, you don't understand that, like that's a coalition. And so if we were to go in and say, you know, to the county committee, which we're involved in or at a higher level and say, you know what, all of our candidates should talk about how abortion can be murder for some people. I understand how they see it that way. It would cause such a shit throwing fisticuffs, you know, throw down the mat because there are key allies of ours who are like, you cannot frame it that way.
Interesting.
And that's what I feel like people
that's
don't understand. It is and it isn't.
It just is, I think.
I kind of understand where they're coming from. I mean, look, we're three men talking about abortion, right? And some, I know some women who are like, the first rule is you don't get to talk about it. I'm like, I kind of see your point.
Yes. I hear that argument for sure. However, I guess like, for example, like I've had situations where I've spoken with women who are pregnant, who are considering an abortion, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they're significant other, you know, has these like very strong opinions, like you can't do that, right? And I've sat down with both of them before and been
wow.
like, you actually get a say, husband.
Yeah.
However, if she goes behind your back, that's her choice. That's how this is going to work.
Wow.
Because at the end of the day, it's in her body and you put it there. And
not only that, but statistically, she's more likely to be the one who's going to be caring for it.
Well, like not only statistically, but if you, any husbands out there who have wives who've had babies, a switch turns on in that woman's brain the second she becomes a mother, and that switch will never turn off. There is a thing that changes in a woman when she becomes a mother where she, I mean, and this is another one of those things where you talk about young men and their motivation for occupation and for life and everything, right? Women are much, and I apologize if this is stereotyping here, but my personal observations, women are much better at being able to do the little things in life, do them and support the things that they love and get the little things done. Men scroll Facebook for hours before they'll get up and do anything because they'll like lament and they'll worry and they'll just like, they're so much less they're so much more worried with this like grandiose way of living. Whereas women are like, dude, I got this thing to feed. You know, I cannot be worried about like the implications of my career and how it really like, go. I mean, again, this is a stereotype, but I think if you really get down to the nitty gritty of family life, I see this over and over again, that the simple survival of life is always through the woman, and that always the grandiose kind of like extraordinariness of life comes from the husband. Now, obviously there's a million ways you could argue with me on that one, but I think there is like, I think this,
if we get emails about this, we'll forward them to you.
Yeah, I would do, because I'll respond to one and then I'll realize this is why
you won't get told. We won't get any emails.
Yeah.
Well, I wish we would.
I wish we would.
So I really want to go to your thought experiment. A Republican is doing outreach to us to vote for them, right? That's what you're setting up.
So Republicans have their guns and abortion thing, dog whistles that just like steer the flock home to the Republicans. What are the Democrats? Is it healthcare? I don't know.
Why did you shut down my thought example? Because why does it matter if it's a dog whistle, if it's not about getting me to vote for Democrat instead of a Republican?
So your thought experiment.
So we're imagining, could we get some Republicans to stop responding in this like sort of knee-jerk way to abortion and guns? And you said, well, what's the equivalent for Democrats? I mean, I think some Republicans would be like, well, it's race. You know, if somebody says that that person is a racist, you won't vote for them. And they might be right a bit. Like Bill Maher is ostracized by a lot of people on the left because they say, I don't know if you've followed any of this, but that, you know, he's an Islamophobe, he's intolerant of Muslims. And Bill Maher is like problematic, I think, but you know, so that might be one, not healthcare, because that's too, it's not as much of a
nuance.
Yeah. And it's complicated.
You know, nuance isn't a slur.
But right. Like if somebody, or even now with Me Too stuff, if somebody said, oh, that politician has a Me Any Too problem, you know, we wouldn't wait for due process.
An ism.
Any of the isms. Which is goes back to what I was saying about within our coalition. I've been in other conversations where, you know, I was suggesting about, for example, immigration, that maybe we should, like, of course, like, everything at the border is a problem. And I am completely concerned with the problems of that. But I was saying, like, I think the Democrats should talk more about how employers are part of the problem. And that language, I got this look like, don't go there. Because if you do, you're flirting with being, you know, anti-immigrant or a racist or whatever, right? And I was like, I was like, I didn't even get to finish the thought. Like, it was just, like, shut down.
Mm, yeah. I think, like, I still think this is, you know, very problematic because, you know, right now we are dealing with just one of the most radical governments in American history. I'm making a lot of claims that I can't back up with facts.
Trust me, you can back that up.
Okay. I should say that I can't, but that people are
good.
Well, more. And I think that there really has to be, from the Democratic perspective, a freedom to just start brainstorming, really brainstorming, and to start from scratch to some extent, because You cannot let fascists win. At this point, it's really that simple. And so you got to stop with the, oh, if we say this, these people won't like us. And if we say that, these people won't like us. And if we imply this, then we imply that. It's like, listen, at this point, you got to just knock it off with the political correctness. You got to just start from scratch. And if you say something that pisses somebody off enough, then the person raises their hand and says, listen, that really pisses me off. And everybody goes, okay, so maybe that's not the right way of going about it. And you move on. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be a sensible way of going about this.
Let's do the game.
Real, one last thing and then the game, because this is a good transition to the game, the thing you said about history. But I do see that there's a little bit of a shift in kind of the culture broadly of sort of left and progressive politics, which is people started to say, like, the call-out culture is a term, like, that is a problem. And the call-out culture, you know, have you seen some of this? Is like that saying that, like, hey, you know, you said something that is an ism, and I'm going to call you out on it. And that emerged from people saying we need to break the silence, right? So there for sure have been periods where it's like somebody would say, like, you know, look, you know, I'm just making up an example. You know, we need to make sure that we don't have too many, you know, black activists because people think the wrong thing about us. And somebody would be like, why did you say that? Right. And so they would kind of internalize. So that's a real thing. And pushing back, you know, I'm following saying Taylor, like pushing back against that is a real thing, but it can go too far too, where even to what I was saying, or another example, I've had people, you know, say to me, like, basically imply, like, look, there's not enough people of color in your organizations where you're doing your work in rural Pennsylvania. That seems like you're part of the problem. I'm like, do you understand that there just aren't that many, right? like sure, this population in Pennsylvania is 20% African American or 15, but not here. So here's the game. Terrible transition. So I've been listening to a whole bunch of different kinds of podcasts recently. One's called Behind the Bastards. Really great. I think you would like it a lot. Like this guy.
Behind the Bastards.
Yeah. And I should give him a better shout out. But he'll do, like, he did this guy, George Lincoln Rockwell. Have you guys ever heard of George Lincoln Rockwell?
No.
You have. What do you know about him? He was like the founder of the American Nazi Party right after World War II.
Wow.
So I've been getting a lot from that, but I also
George Lincoln Bastard.
Yeah, no, George Lincoln.
So many Nazis came to the United States.
Well,
it's a lot.
This guy was
homegrown. Paperclip.
That's fascinating too. That's bringing in the Nazi scientists. No, but this guy was homegrown. In fact, he was a fighter pilot. Where was he from?
I bet he's from Wisconsin.
I mean, that's interesting too. If you think about Wisconsin is like the keystone state for the next election, and how it's been on this tipping point between being kind of what the, I was just actually listening to an interview on Pod Save America with the head of the Wisconsin Democratic Party. Did you hear that?
I've listened to interviews with him.
Okay. This one we could do a whole nother podcast was fascinating. It goes to what we were saying, but anyway, so I've been listening to Behind the Bastards. So one was about George Nelson Rockwell. Another one was about the militia movements, which I kind of forgot about, but like in the 80s and 90s. And they actually, a lot of them drew their inspiration from this guy Rockwell, but you know, they were the ones, for example, they were talking about building a wall in the 90s. And I kind of forgot that, but it's just my point to what you're saying about how radical it is that these things that were considered crazy fringe in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, you know, Trump has been the normalizer of all of it. So here's the game. And the third thing, sorry, I was listening to a podcast, really interesting one, with the guy who wrote a book about the early anthropologists like Ruth Benedict and Margaret Mead and Franz Boas, who were late 1900s, early 20th century, late 1800s, early 1900s. You know, there was this whole, interesting what you're saying about expertise and being technocratic, you know, because there's a part of our collective progressive history that did like that. You know, having milk that's not tainted is a good thing. You know, labeling our food and drugs is a good thing. But eugenics and progressivism were deeply interlinked, and it was a kind of a faith in science. So there was this whole part of intellectual people who were trying to basically prove that, you know, Western Europeans and Americans and white people, Nordic white people, were like the most superior. And so these early anthropologists were some of the first people to write against that. But they were talking about this guy, Madison Grant. So Madison Grant was from a rich New York family. And he was a conservationist. He was some sort of academic historian or something. He was one of the key people for helping to save the bison in the West and starting the Bronx Zoo. So these things, you know, it's not
easy. He was super anti-immigration.
Well, what he thought he saw was when you have species mingle, lower species went out. And he wrote this book that was called The Passing of the Great Race. And he was super worried that all the immigrants coming from, it's even interesting how they used race, you know, they would have considered Italian a different race, Irish a different race. So he wrote this book about this. And just one thing from the interview with the author was like, Hitler read Passing of the Great Race as he was finishing Mein Kampf. And I think in the Library of Congress or at a library in New York is his version of the German translation of Madison Grant's book with his annotations that he was reading as he was finishing Mein Kampf, right? So
really,
yeah,
have that copy?
Somewhere in the United States. I don't remember where.
That's amazing.
So here's the game. That was a long windup. So I've got several quotes. Some are from George Lincoln Rockwell. Some are from someone in the Trump administration, and some. And some are from this guy, Madison Grant. So I'm going to read a quote, and you guys have to guess whether it's Madison Grant, George Lincoln Rockwell, or Trump.
So Grant, Rockwell, or Trump.
Right.
Okay. It's not Trump, but it's somebody.
Actually, one of them is Trump. Okay. Here's the first one. A leopard doesn't change his spots just because you bring him in from the jungle and try to housebreak him and turn him into a pet. He may learn to sheathe his claws in order to beg a few scraps off the dinner table, and you may teach him to be a beast of burden, but it doesn't pay to forget that he'll always be what he was born, a wild animal.
I would say that's probably not the guy who started the zoos.
That was Grant.
Yeah, so Rockwell. That's my guess.
Yeah, that's right. George Lincoln Rockwell. Okay, next one. It sometimes happens that an infiltration of population takes place either in the guise of unwilling slaves or of willing immigrants who fill up waste places and take the lowly tasks which the lords of the land despise, thus gradually occupying the country and literally breeding out their masters.
Definitely Grant.
It's Grant. It's Grant. But isn't it interesting how you're like, yeah, that? I mean, in a different vernacular, for sure, that could have been Stephen Miller. All right, here's another one. You can continue to worship at the altar of multiculturalism, and we may come to see that we are participating in the sacrifice of the one culture which binds us all.
That sounds like Steve Bannon.
I would go also with Grant.
Fun. That is Stephen Miller.
Oh, that is fun. Well, can you actually say that again then?
You can continue to worship at the altar of multiculturalism, and we may come to see that we are participating in the sacrifice of the one culture which binds us all. That's so fascinating, because I actually would say multiculturalism is the culture that, one ring to bind them all.
Right.
I mean, right, you know, they're saying, you know, it's this whole thing that, like, I'm so aggrieved that, you know, you've taken away my hegemony, right? That, like, I get to say that what you're saying, Christianity. I'm like, you know, America has always been a melting pot. Have you looked at the history of New York or Pennsylvania?
Oh,
or,
my goodness, yeah, of course.
I feel like Pennsylvania could have easily gone communist.
I mean,
in the early days?
In the early days.
I mean, that wasn't
like,
a thing.
Like, 100 but, years ago.
Oh. I thought you meant when Penn came.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Wow. All right. One more?
Yeah, one more.
You're a slave in your own country, white man. Each year you get to keep less of the fruits of your labor. Each year it gets more difficult to carry the burden the aliens have placed upon you. Each year the cheap labor of aliens makes your future less secure. Each year you retreat a few steps more into the world of slavery.
Yeah, it's got to be Donald Trump.
It's actually Hitler from Mein Kampf.
Oh
no!
Oh. I was like,
that's George Lincoln Rockwell.
Wow.
Yes. Isn't that fascinating?
What a jerk.
Okay, one more.
White man, he says.
I have black guys counting my money. I hate it. The only guys I want counting my money are short guys that wear yarmulkes. And you know what? Laziness is a trait in blacks. Yarmulkes. Laziness is a who's the anti-Semite? Laziness is a trait in blacks. It really is. I believe that.
That's a
Donald Trump.
Totally
Donald Trump.
Yeah, that's got it.
That's what he said?
Yes.
That's
lazy.
I want short guys with yarmulkes.
Counting my money.
Ay, Dios mío.
Oy vey. All right, what do we have left? I really want to do your Warren thing. Can we just do it for a minute?
Yeah, and then, So I was sitting at Amami.
Love me in Italian. Look it up.
Amami.
That actually.
Amami.
Definitely not Amami.
People say Amami and Davide doesn't like it. It's Amami.
It's not.
Amami.
It's not Amami. It's not Edamami. It's not my mommy. It's Amami.
Do people say.
I'll pick up the phone sometimes.
What percentage edamami of people say it right?
Only,
of your customers.
Only the
less
immigrants
than 10. I should, because it's like Spanish. It would
Amami?
Be.
Amami.
In Spanish, Amami. It would be Amami.
Yeah, it's only, like, it's probably about 20%.
Say it right,
yeah. Yeah, but actually I learned Siam, not the actual pronunciation. Siam, the way we say it, is really Siam, which is actually the territory of Thailand before it was called Thailand.
Well, that I knew, but you should say it Siam.
Is what I've been told, yeah.
Siam.
Okay. All right.
But the point is, you buy food from them, they don't really care.
So
capitalism, baby!
I was sitting at Amami, and I was talking with this couple that was in town from Washington, D.C., and halfway through the conversation, I realized they were both wearing Elizabeth Warren t-shirts. And I've been pretty much on the sidelines of this presidential mashup. But I said, oh, that's cool. You know, glad to see.
What is it? Did you say, Emma, what is it when you have like 20 people in an octagon? Isn't there a word for that in a fight? Didn't you say something about MMA? Do you like?
Oh, like in the old WWE stuff, it was like a Royal Rumble.
Royal Rumble.
Yeah, yeah. So in the presidential.
See, Royal I was Rumble. Listening earlier.
so then I was like, yeah, no, you know, I'm pretty torn between you know her and Bernie, and I like Andrew Yang too, and they just start kind of berating me about like, well, Bernie's never done anything, and you know, like. You know, name one thing Bernie Sanders has ever done. And they start going after me about Bernie Sanders. And it's just, it really turned me off to, I mean, not necessarily Elizabeth Warren, but I started kind of defending Bernie because, you know, it didn't, you know, he is a good politician, you know. And anyway, it just got me thinking, you know, to all those that are fighting for a particular candidate out there. It's better to talk about how your candidate is good instead of how the other one's bad. In general, also. Because I just, it really turned me off.
You know, I have a really interesting thought that goes along those exact lines here. It happens to do with the local election.
Sorry.
Don't worry about that one, guys. We'll edit it. But it goes along with what you just said, and actually it has to do with this local election, and it was a bit of a stomach turner for me, if I could share it. But it was basically on, like, the day before the election, there was this, like, and I really only caught the tail end of the news of it on Facebook, but it was basically this, like, radio interview that got kind of, like, awry, apparently, right, where there was some Democratic, some gay Democratic constituents, maybe is the right
word,
that were pretty offended by the fact that David Roe was kind of this like closeted or semi-closeted gay Republican candidate. And that, to your point earlier, Jordy, that this is a position that represents everybody. It doesn't just represent Republicans. It represents everybody. And for people who had to struggle with the growing up in a closet like that, to be kind of dismet, like put aside by this person that are involved in politics was really offensive, right? Which I think is a good message. But what kind of turned my stomach a little bit was that like it got mean quick from how I perceived it. From my end, right? From how I saw it on the internet, right? And all of a sudden, I was like, oh my God, the Republicans are going to look at the Democrats and be like, see, you guys don't like gay people now. Because it had that sort of like, that like ability to all of a sudden like flip over and be used against you, right? And I think to your point, Taylor, which is like, anytime you start criticizing, you always end up in this place where intellectual people can now flip it on you. And so it's so much better to just be positive when you can be than to be like really like just start going at them with the criticism. I mean, obviously there's some things that you have to stand up for at the end of the day, right? And I mean, I think like, I think the fundamental message here was a quality message. Which is like, hey man, you represent everybody, right?
Yeah.
But
and you're kind of throwing us under the
bus. And you're kind of throwing us under the bus. But it got a little like cringy for me at one point because all of a sudden I was like, oh man, I hope this doesn't go into that place where all of a sudden it's like, well, he said this and she said that and you said this and we're this and blah, 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 you know what I mean? Because that wasn't ever the point.
Yeah.
And that's kind of like, that's sort of where I saw that like tail end of that thing going.
Well, I think the issue with that, which I know exactly what you're talking about, was during the debate the day before the election.
The radio show.
Yeah. One of the people that actually is on this podcast frequently, Dwayne, who's a gay man that's involved in politics. called in to say something about this to the same effect of like, you know, I have concerns about this.
Yeah.
And he was bleeped off the air and was hung up
on him.
Well, they hung up on him and then totally
like redacted
it from the live broadcast.
And only that, like, I think their logic based on what they said was, we won't allow personal attacks. And one of the things is like, for us, saying you're gay is not a personal attack.
Yeah, exactly.
It's what we're saying is, if you're gay, how are you going to vote on issues that directly affect that community?
Sure.
Because I haven't heard Dan say he's
a
Pope.
That whole issue was totally sidelined because nobody on that program wanted to bring up that issue.
Even the idea that it's a personal attack is itself participating in like the culture of homophobic thinking.
Yes.
Right? I'm not saying that the Mark and the other people on WKKR, but it's like they decided that this was a personal attack. And for our side, I'm like, that's just who you are.
Right.
And I don't care what you are, David Rowe or anybody else, but it, and this is the, this is the Barney Frank.
How are you
going to
vote
on
all this shit? You can still be fired in Pennsylvania if you're gay.
And coming back
to, not against the law.
And coming back to life and death, you know, there's a bill that would not allow healthcare professionals to recommend conversion therapy to minors. And we know that conversion therapy, what's called conversion therapy, that the idea that you can fix in quotes, air quotes, people who are gay, has negative health impacts, including a higher suicide rate. So
like 8 times high.
That's right. This is life and death for some people. So, you know, the interesting thing about what you were saying earlier about like, we want politics to be in a space where we have some common values, and those common values would say we can disagree, but we're not going to get into like a kind of, we're not going to get into a kind of like eliminationist politics where we're saying like, you're not an American or you're not a good person, right? Like, I think what you're saying is we don't want politics to be that way.
Right.
But sometimes on these issues, like that comes up and it's hard to avoid that because
it's hard
for me to just kind of I can easily disagree with somebody about what the marginal tax rate should be for the wealthy.
Right.
I have a harder time finding some common ground on whether or not conversion therapy is legit.
Yes, I agree completely. I think there's absolutely these kind of like elusive answers.
Yeah.
And then there's a little bit
the
more
is,
like black and white kind of like, that's definitely wrong.
Yeah. Or as a taxpayer, I don't want to be paying for that.
Right. Because at the end of the day, right, there's
you can do that, but that should not be covered with government health insurance.
Yeah.
Right.
You know,
right.
Right.
That's pretty fucking black.
Well, and the Pennsylvania bill has to do with it gets more tricky. It has to do with licensing. So it's basically saying it's not even taxpayer dollars going to conversion therapy. It's saying we are not going to recognize your license as like a professional healthcare provider prescribe or recommend. I wanted to come back to the Warren Sanders thing. So two things. One, I've tracked this thing down that I remembered hearing about a while. This is from May and it was Iowa voters, but it was Biden's supporters' second choice. And 27% of Biden's supporters, sorry, there's two polls, between 27 and 30% of Biden supporters, they said their second choice was Bernie. But 0% of Bernie supporters said their second choice was Biden.
That makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah.
Which I thought was interesting, but it kind of goes to like the, you know, somebody I heard was saying that, you know, if you type in for a lot of reporters, DEM Democrats, it's like an autocorrect to Democrats in disarray. Like this is such a common trope for like the punditry class and the media to say Democrats in disarray. I'm like, well, what do you mean? Like we're having a normal process of having a bunch of candidates run and they disagree.
There's not a fucking tyrant out there in the center of the stage calling people Little Marco.
Yeah.
Debates about Medicare for all and climate change and stuff like that.
But to go back to what you're saying, Taylor, like I really think we should pun and have not pun, but we should, you know, revisit this because I mean I run into similar things more online, but this kind of you know, that you are risking electing another fascist if you support this person. Like that's the basic formula, right? If you don't support my preferred candidate, you likely Democratic voter.
That's so corrosive to me.
It is so corrosive. And you and I have both seen it in different forms, right? And I don't love Biden and I'd have a hard time getting behind him. But if he wins a lot of primaries and wins the process, I'm kind of like, then he's probably a good choice, right?
Well, I mean, I don't care how good of a choice he is. I definitely will not vote for Trump. So, I mean,
he's
probably going to get my vote.
I mean, I mean, Indivisible's been trying to get individual people to take a pledge, both politicians. There's a politician's version, but it's an indivisible pledge. And basically it says, you know, I'll support the final nominee. You know, I'll fight hard and fair. That's not quite what it is, but fight hard and fair for my preferred candidate. But I will support the eventual nominee, and I'll do everything I can to make sure that Trump doesn't win. And I'm almost like, before you tell me who I should support, I want to know that you signed that, like either literally or in your heart,
right?
You know,
yeah.
Because that's the kind of like cultural shift we need, right? And this whole like, you know, you know, you cost the election last time because you supported Bernie or whatever,
right?
Like, it's so corrosive.
I'm so over it. I'm so over it.
And also, like, I don't know if there's any, like, scientific or poll data that would even, like, back up any of those kind of claims. That's literally just rhetoric.
We somehow need to have a big conversation because, if I wish Sam were here because she knows the research in this better. It is for sure true that the Russian hackers ginned up some Bernie supporters and some Jill Stein supporters, and they basically stoked after Hillary was the nominee. They stoked that, right?
And a lot of racial stuff, too.
I mean, all kinds of shit. I mean, they were just like, throw lots of stuff at the wall and see what sticks.
Right.
And I think that some people don't realize that. But then the other thing is some people think that anybody who supported Bernie was a Russian tool. And I'm like, please.
Yeah, right.
Like,
yeah.
I supported Sanders in 2016. Is that the right year?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's not my favorite choice now.
Yeah. It's funny because I had that same, like, conundrum when this, like, 2020 election started coming up because – I was like a big Bernie guy in 2016, and I actually contributed like $35 twice to the.
That's 10% of your take home pay.
Yeah, it is actually. Fun fact: we can have a whole podcast on that one. But you know, and you know, actually, to the like ridiculousness of what these like Elizabeth Warren people are saying, like he has basically pioneered modern day crowdfunding for politics.
Howard Dean did it first.
Howard Dean and Obama.
Well, yeah, but I mean, to the extent at which he was able to,
he has power because he can raise money, and the money he raises comes from a big, broad constituency that is not typical Democratic donors.
Yes, yes, and I think that whole process is extremely important to like recognize that like the fact that money wins elections is not really false, and the fact that a little bit of money from all the people that support you in the real working class can be almost as powerful as anybody else.
I mean, to me, and this goes to what I'm saying, you know, I know some people are like, well, I'm not sure I agree on his, you know, Medicare for All plan, and over 10 years will cost X trillion dollars. And I'm like, I haven't read his policy plan. And, you know, if you know me, like, I'm hyper overeducated. I can read policy papers. This goes to what I was saying earlier. I'm like, the thing that attracted me to him then and still now, I still respect him a lot, was like he has a way of talking about these populist issues and how it is the structural problems of class in our country.
And he makes it really easy to understand.
It's super so easy. When I saw his interview, so I was very like wishy-washy in 2020. 2016, very clear. 2020, I was like, I don't know.
You're saying 2020, I was like, it hasn't even happened yet.
Well, you know.
Will you say who you're liking now?
I'm John Connor. Do I have what?
John Connor?
Who's that?
Like the guy who's going to save us from the Terminator?
Yes.
Oh.
do you have like
a preferred candidate?
So as of right now, I am.
You can take the fifth.
Well, no, as of right now, I'm split only in a couple of directions because, you know.
Please say Marianne Williamson.
but like what you were saying about Andrew. And his kind of whole idea of this like universal minimum.
UBI,
universal basic income.
Basic income. You know, I think to what his point is saying about like how automation is going to,
it's not annoying to have, you know, a professor on the podcast.
No, listen, otherwise I'm going to stutter over some words after a couple of these Lafroigs. So, to the points of his making, he was just like, yes, there are fundamental, predictable future outcomes that are going to happen because of this, and we need to come up with these solutions
right now.
And so to me, I think like there's a lot about that. And also to kind of combine that idea with what we were just saying about Bernie is that Bernie kind of does the same things, which is like, he makes me feel really good because he's saying the stuff that's in my head. And as long as there's a candidate who's like actually supporting the stuff that I'm thinking about, I'm like, really, it makes me feel really good because someone is just saying like, listen, the real issue here is the fact that there are billions and billions of dollars being collected by these corporate entities that are really not recycling any of that capital back into
the
economy, mm-hmm. right? The idea that capitalism works is fundamental in this idea of recycling, that the money can funnel up, but then has to somehow make its way back down.
Most business people are not capitalists, not in the way you mean. I mean, this is something I learned being in, I don't know if you've ever heard me talk
about it. As an employee who's currently going through one of the most annoying things possible right now, it is fundamentally the same thing, which is like, I was told just the other day that like the fact that me as an asset can be negotiated, my worth is negotiable, is just a fundamental quality of capitalism. And I was like, wait, so you're saying that like you can dictate what I'm worth and my work is worth because of this idea that like, it's an arbitrary capitalistic principle? It's ridiculous.
That's interesting. I lost you a little bit there, but what I was going to say was like, you know, I can remember being, you know, when I was doing my graduate education in management and business, like all these people in this lecture about, it was an economist trying to explain that like, you know, that the price for text messaging should be about what the marginal cost is to them, right? And so that text messages should be really cheap. And at the time they were trying to charge like 5 cents. This was in euros. And it was just really clear to me that like most business people, of course, want a monopoly or close to it. And that is the exact opposite of what a capitalist system needs. And, you know, that doesn't get talked about. You know, people are just like, oh, if you're a business person, you like capitalism. Like, no, they don't. Very few business people have the ethical fiber to actually like what capitalism is because it depends on competitive
like
markets.
Competition,
and they don't want competitive markets.
No, and I think it's weird because like I keep on hearing, you know, this idea like, capitalism is failing and capitalism is a failure and capitalism is the problem, right? And
What does that even mean? I mean, what was it supposed to be? What was the success metric in the first place?
Well, I think that's a good point. I think to your point, it's possible that it was always sort of a mask or a persona to monopolies. I think it's possible that it had some sort of idealistic origin, but it never really filled itself through just like time and how, you know, people are. But I think, you know, to my earlier point is that like in the way I view it, it needs a recycling mechanism of some sort. And in our modern day society, that is taxes. Taxes will obviously recycle the wealth back to the people in various either like actual things like infrastructure or healthcare stuff, or it's like tax breaks or whatever. You know what I mean? It can be cash. It doesn't really matter, right? But there really is none of that happening at this point at a fair level compared to like how much is actually going in. And so you're just seeing this inequity growing because you're stockpiling money.
Yeah. I mean, this is the result of really calculated moves by Reagan and Bush and Trump, really.
Yeah. And, you know, and so, yeah, you know.
We should wrap up, but I kind of wanted to come back to, like, one small thing. I don't remember what it was. Sorry.
The rainforest.
Oh.
R.I.P. I don't know.
Before we started recording, you were talking about existentialism versus, I don't remember what the other ism was, but.
Well, I mean, I basically am just like, oh, fuck. You know, like, about the rainforest. I haven't really done any research about it other than to know that we're really fucking screwed about it. And, I read that Bolsonaro rejected the aid money. Because he was offended by Macron's statements. And Trump supports Bolsonaro in rejecting the aid money. And so the Amazon will continue to burn.
Well, I like actually think it's really important because I told this the other day, which is like the rainforest is not burning. The rainforest is being burned. Right.
Yeah.
That's a great point.
Big difference. Right. Yeah. It's not like, oh, these wildfires and we can't do anything about it.
Yeah.
Like, no, like it's being clear cut and burned. It's being burned. Right. There's a big difference.
Uh-oh, we're busted. here's one of our most loyal sponsors herself. we were just talking about how much we enjoy Mondragon's sponsorship of the podcast.
Nice. I bought it, Scott.
Thank you so much. Rainforest.
So that's like the thing about it, right?
Here's the crazy fucked up thing. Like, I'm a little bit older than you guys. Just turned 47, so you're probably like
30.
You're 30. Like, I'm like, it's still there. Like, I mean, when I was in the 80s, it was like, oh my god, the rainforests are burning. And so I'm like thankful. I'm like, I didn't even know it was still there. I thought it was all gone by now.
Well, I just saw that.
You know, because it's been such an issue for so long.
I just saw this David Attenborough documentary earlier today, and it was like saying that, like, in Borneo, which is
in Malaysia or Indonesia,
in Southeast Asia, yeah, it's got one of the oldest rainforests in the world.
Yeah.
And in the last 50 years, the size of the rainforest has dropped to about 50% of its size, right? So that's in 50 years, it's halved, right? And in Indonesia, 90% of the original rainforests are gone, right?
Yeah.
The Congo, which is the second largest rainforest in the world, is being ravished by industrialists and poacher. I mean, it's just, you're seeing huge species being just wiped out, huge components of the ecosystem. And then, yeah, and then obviously you have the Amazon being intentionally clear cut for what is essentially McDonald's hamburgers.
I don't think I can take any more, guys. Should we wrap it up?
I have one thing I want to share with you, which may make you feel worse.
That's
or better.
That's not a good way to end it, though.
I don't know. No. So I don't know if you guys heard about this. This was apparently it's from like last week. I think Trump in a national security, like the daily briefing about like threats. Trump says, I got it. Why don't we nuke them? They start forming off the coast of Africa. As they're moving across the Atlantic, we drop a bomb inside the eye of the hurricane and it disrupts it. Why can't we do that? Did you know this?
I did know that, yeah. let's just nuke the hurricane.
We'll just...
What could go wrong?
Yeah, what could... How bad could it be?
No.
Instead of a hurricane destroying Florida, we can have a radioactive hurricane destroying Florida. And the best is, do you know what movie... This is a great callback. I've never seen this, but that comes up in a movie. It's either the Meg or Sharknado or the Meg, one or the other. One of these stupid movies, they nuke a hurricane. So this is where the quote-unquote leader of the free world is getting his ideas.
Stone Creek, Penn Creek, Pine Creek, Chambersburg, Middle Creek, Blakeslee, Falls Creek, Shepherdsburg, Goffstown, Allentown, Shepherdstown, Lords Valley, Daisytown, Doylestown, Downingtown, Cherry Valley, Plain Grove, Mill Grove, Mechanics Row, Swissvale, Ferndale, Carbondale, Monongahela, oh well. I've been everywhere, man. I crossed the valley, spare man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man.